All right, go ahead and get started. Hey, everybody. Welcome to TechEd. Well, not welcome, I guess it's already Wednesday. But thank you for attending my session. Today we're going to be talking about some best practices for migrating from an on-premises solution to Office 365. Going to talk a lot about migrations that I've actually done in the past, try and pass along some of the tips and tricks and techniques to make your migration smoother. And to help you along the way. Just to kind of get a gauge of where everybody is, are most people out here the IT admins, or do we have the kind of decision makers here? A little bit of both? Yeah? Okay, got some nodding heads. Okay, good. All right, so just to let you know a little bit about me and where I'm coming from, I'm a cloud solutions architect with Planet Technologies. I focus in the state and local government, also higher education. I have designed and deployed over 25 enterprise solutions for Office 365 from various on-premises solutions from GroupWise, Domino, Exchange in its various forms. Also migrated from hosted solutions such as Google and some of the other solutions that are out there. As of today, I've migrated over 75,000 users up to the cloud. Rough guesstimate of how many I've moved. Most of the organizations that I deal with are about 2,500 users and up. I've dealt with some of the larger enterprise, 50,000 users and above. For the most part, my role is to come in and evaluate the situation, understand what their environment is, and develop the strategy to migrate, set them up to a point where they get to a pilot, and then kind of hand off to the end users and the admins to finalize the migrations. Planet Technologies is a premier partner with Microsoft, and we're one of the leading Office 365 integrators and also a partner with the BPOS to Office 365 transition. For anybody that's been involved in the BPOS transitions, you'll know that there's not much to do during the transition. That's really handled by Microsoft. It's really helping clean up a little bit of the mess after the fact and potentially helping in the beginning to set up the ADFS and the DirSync to get that ready for the customers when they're moving. Someone before the session was asking if we're going to cover that. I don't have anything specific, but I may, you know, if we have a little bit extra time, I may touch on a few of the migrations I've done and touch on some of the interesting hiccups that we've run into. I'm also an Exchange MVP and an MCITP in the Office 365, and some of my handles down there. My blog, I post pretty exclusively to Office 365. Again, a lot of the things we're covering here today, a lot of PowerShell scripts and things that I've done to automate the process and make it easier to transition. And some of the things I've run into, like the ADFS one-year auto-renewal for the certificate that some people may have run into after a year, all of a sudden ADFS stops working because the certificate doesn't roll over properly. So I've blogged about a lot of that. I'm also active in the community, community.office365.com. It's a great place to go and post questions and help out and learn a lot about the system. So as an introduction, we'll talk a little bit about the source. If you look through a lot of the deployment guides, it kind of assumes a pretty basic understanding of what your environment is, but as you all know, the environments are different. You can have 10 different organizations that all have Exchange 2003, and every single organization is unique. Everyone has their own problems, their own special customizations, different problems in terms of the number of users that they're handling or the process or the people that are involved in administering the system. It may have been a migration from, say, GroupWise that went to Exchange, so you have some of the additional attributes in GroupWise that are still tagged in your user accounts. So every environment is really unique, and with that comes a unique set of problems that doesn't necessarily get identified in a lot of the enterprise deployment guides. So a lot of times you'll see a lot of different people becoming frustrated because they're running into problems and the deployment guide doesn't necessarily cover exactly their specific situation. And you can imagine with a million different customers out there, there's a million different problems. Some of the source environments we'll discuss here. We'll discuss Domino and Lotus Notes. We'll also discuss migrating from the various Exchange platforms. Touch on GroupWise a little bit. And we'll also touch on Google a little bit, as much as it pains me. And as an introduction to Office 365, this is a 300-level discussion here, so hopefully you guys are pretty familiar with it. But just as a quick recap, Office 365 is a cloud-based offering that provides services for Exchange Online, SharePoint Online, Link Online, and also Office Professional Plus. For those of you who haven't been down there, definitely swing by the Office 365 booth. We've got a humongous area down there, lots of room to move and lots of cool toys to play with. We've been fielding a lot of questions from people and been a little bit, actually, honestly surprised at some of the questions coming up in terms of, you know, what is Office 365, how can I get Office Professional Plus to install, and how different is it, and what are the various ways that, it's different, but it really isn't. Office Pro Plus is Office Pro Plus, just like if you bought it off a shelf. It's the exact same copy. It's just how it connects up to the cloud. So for anyone who's using RPC over HTTP for Exchange 2003 or Outlook Anywhere, as it gets up to the newer versions, you'll know that it's the exact same type of connectivity. It's Exchange 2010 backend. So, there's really not much of a difference. The big thing is that you're getting rid of the infrastructure. So for anyone that attended Alistair's session yesterday, Alistair and Marcus, they talked about the kind of 3 to 5 year spikes in cost. The biggest selling point that I've found so far about Office 365 is it's a continual cost. You're paying on a per user per month. So every 3 to 5 years when the next version comes out, you don't have to worry about going out and learning it and getting the training to understand it. Designing your migration, testing out the migration, buying this huge amount of hardware and software and CALs and upgrades and get everyone up to speed and run through all the problems. When the next version comes out, you get an email, and one day the next version's there. And, it's really just about training your users. So the kind of continuous update that you get with Office 365 really gives you, a huge advantage. And the other thing that I've heard a lot about from people is, what happens to, my IT staff? And, I don't think necessarily the goal for Office 365 is to get rid of your IT staff. I know in, some of the early versions in last year when it was first coming out, that was kind of one of the ways it was sort of being marketed a little bit. But, you have all the same access in Office 365 that you have in the in an on-premises solution. So you have PowerShell, you have the Exchange Control Panel, you have the Management Shell. You have, a ton of different ways to access it, and you really have 95 to 98% of all the commandlets that you need to be able to manage your system. And we'll see later here when I go through some of the PowerShell scripts that I have. So before I'm going to try and cover some of the technical side as well, but one of the things that I found that seems to cause a lot more problem than necessarily the technical problems are the logistical problems. So, the one thing I have here is someone told me when I first started in IT, what costs a dollar now is going to cost you $100 in a week and $1,000 in a month. And I cannot state how important this is. I have a customer that I always use as my example. They were an early adopter. It was 7,500 users that were migrating. And we migrated, we set them up, ADFS, the full hybrid coexistence with 2003 and 2010 on-premises. They used System Center to get all their desktops up to speed. And they had a mix of Office 2007 and Office 2010. We migrated their IT staff first, which for some reason everyone wants to pilot their IT staff first, but IT staff is the worst group to migrate. Because every time, we mess with our machines more than anybody. So it's ridiculous. There's 50,000 applications that aren't approved that are on the IT workstations that are never on your users. So I got a call on a Saturday afternoon while I was on vacation with my family from three of the product leads at Microsoft saying, customer wants to cancel the migration. They put everything on hold. You told them this was going to work. It's not working. Everyone's disconnecting from Outlook, and it's all your fault. Well, what ended up happening was they used the desktop setup and they downloaded it and deployed it through SCCM. But what ended up happening is if you install it through SCCM, it's a silent install. So if you don't meet the prerequisites, it'll install and it'll run as a service, but it won't do anything. So what they found is they'd come in the morning and random times during the day, their desktop would say trying to connect. And basically what ended up happening was they had Service Pack 2 and their SCCM guy swore up and down, everyone had Service Pack 2. And so I sat down in front of three machines and found that they had Service Pack 2 for Office, but 2 months later they had installed Visio and Project 2007. which required Service Pack 2, which they did not install. So each of the machines caused a problem. So I sat down with the CIO and about 14 VPs and executive people from Microsoft, all breathing heavily on my neck and demanding that I had the answer. And I pulled it up and I installed the prerequisites of Service Pack 2 and connected everyone, and they never had another problem. The problem that ended up happening was obviously I had to come home from vacation. My wife didn't speak to me for 2 or 3 months. It wasn't very fun. But we also had to stop the migration for 7,500 users. So it ended up I charged them for every minute I was there. So it ended up costing them about $25,000 for that week of me doing nothing but explaining to them that this wasn't done correctly. So really planning on the front end, I can't stress it enough. And every time I go now to another customer, you're always going to get fight back from the admins that are out there and the people that don't necessarily touch the IT systems all the time. And, oh, this is fine. And, oh, we can, we'll make this compromise and here and that. And it's really just not, from my perspective, I'd never compromise anymore. And if I do, I get it in written statement that says, hey, we know that this is not the way it's supposed to be, but so that when we come back, I can hold it up and say, hey, this is why it's not working. So not only from the technical side, but also from the business process side. Migrations can be won and lost based on what your user experience is. So you can have the best migration in the world, but let's say you're coming from GroupWise, or they have Lotus Notes and they've never seen Outlook before. You don't necessarily do a great training session. Your users are going to hate it. It may be better, but they've spent the last 10, 15 years using GroupWise. Now they all of a sudden they have to use Outlook. So understanding the business process and how are we going to get the training out there and who's going to be on the front end, how's the help desk going to be available, and how are they going to understand how to troubleshoot these problems? When a user calls and says, I have X problem, is that something that I know I can fix immediately? Or is this something that I'm going to have to come back and say, all right, well, here, let me talk to my migration team. This is a problem on the back end. And how are we going to get all that training done? It's a lot of stuff that really needs to be done before really you touch any of the systems. And it goes with most projects, but with Office 365, it really exacerbates problems if you don't understand these ahead of time. So once we understand all the business process, then we come into some of our common discovery tools. The first one is one that I always use out of the gate. It's the Office 365 Deployment Readiness Tool, and I'll pull it up here in a minute and show you a couple examples of why it's really important to use. But basically, the tool will go through and it gathers a ton of information in terms of what your environment looks like, and not from what your admins are telling you it looks like, but what it actually is. And again, Alistair, to mention him again, yesterday he said, you have an environment and you're used to, I've got 15,000 users, and all of a sudden you run directory sync and it craps out at 20,000 users, and you run this report and it turns out they have 75,000 users because they haven't deleted anything from their Active Directory in 20 years. So it's really important to run these tools ahead of time. Not only is it important to run it just to get a better understanding, but it's really important because when you're actually provisioning the tenant, you can request an extra large tenant out of the gate. So when you purchase the tenant, it's going to have a 20,000 user limit. If you know you have 40,000 users, you can immediately create a service request, say, here's the report, we have 40,000 users, here's the proof of it, and I think I've done it in the last 5 or 6 deployments I've had, and within a day or two of actually provisioning the tenant, I have my limit increase. So it's something that really helps kind of not run into that hiccup of having dir-sync broken for a day or two and hold up your migration during that initial point. And that's always, the very beginning of the project is always when everyone's very focused on you and there's a big spotlight, kind of like these, shining on you. So it really helps to make sure everything goes smoothly from the get-go, and then everyone will kind of back off. It's okay. They really know what they're doing. They're ahead of the curve here. So with that, we'll take a quick peek at a couple of the readiness tools I have here. First one we're going to look at is, this is actually my tenant. So it's just a very small tenant. I have the entire cast of South Park on it, so about 40 characters here, various names and other things. But you can see the tool itself brings up a lot of good information, and you can quick link to any of these, and it covers all of the various areas. Now, they're working on a few versions that will actually ask some questions beforehand, so that if you know you're not going to use link, it'll just leave that out of the report. If anyone's ever run this in a really big environment, it can take a while. It really just needs to be run on any domain join machine. There are some minimum requirements. Don't run it on, you know, Windows 95. But basically, you just run it. It reads your directory. It doesn't do any writing to it. And it pulls back this information, then you can save it. And this is your proof. Again, if you have more than the number of objects or you need to go back and say, you know, you need to fix this in your environment before we get started, this gives you your firm proof that, yeah, you say you have this, but this is what the actual truth is. So that's what the report is. And any of these items here, you can come in. Let me see if I can find one that's actually broken. They have a lot of links here, so like the deployment guides, Active Directory cleanup, hybrid requirements, things like that. But once you get into an actual problem, you can actually look at the CSV. So here we have some questionable data. I can click review the results. Okay, so I have a discovery search mailbox that has, you know, the ridiculous GUID. That's going to cause a problem, but I know it's a discovery mailbox, so it doesn't really matter because that's never going to leave my on-prem anyway. But if there were other ones, a lot of times when you migrate from legacy systems or when you migrate from, say, Lotus Notes, they'll have spaces in the names. So you have to go through and you have to adjust and, you know, concatenate them or put an underscore in the names and do a lot of cleanup beforehand. And as an example of a customer that I had, this was one of their problems here. So they said they had about 10,000 mailboxes, and it turns out they had 49,000 items in their Active Directory. And they didn't believe me. I actually ran this report and I showed it to them, and they're like, no, prove it. I'm like, how else do I prove it? I have the report right here. Like, I had to literally like go through each OU and like start counting numbers. It was an interesting deployment. So this is, you know, it's good and bad because sometimes it proves the person wrong that's stating emphatically that, you know, their environment is perfect and infallible. One of the other things I wanted to point out, now this is the same report. This specific environment had an empty root and then had two child domains. And as you know, the directory synchronization tool as it stands right now is an all or nothing. You can filter by OU, but it's not supported by Microsoft. Don't ever do it. It's really a bad idea. But there's some stuff coming down the road that will definitely help with that. What ended up happening here was they had 23 admin accounts that they had put in the resource domain that had identical accounts in the child domain. And so they were trying to figure out, you know, why they were getting, when you go into the admin console, you'll see users with errors. And what ended up happening is they had duplicate names in the environment. And it doesn't necessarily pick the root first and the child first. It may pick some from the root, some from the child, so some accounts may be okay, some may not be okay. But it was something that I could point out really easily and quickly and say, hey, let's just clean this up beforehand. And it turned out these 23 accounts, they didn't need them at all. So they just purged those accounts and then they were good. But it's a really good way, and then you can export each of these CSVs and provide them to the customer and say, okay, well, here's the work you need to do. You know, I'm going to go to the beach and hang out and call me in a couple of weeks when you're ready to go. All right, let's jump back over here. So again, that's the readiness tool. It can be downloaded. Actually, jump back over here for one quick second. It can be downloaded from the community, so community.office365.com. You can just go Bing it and just Bing Office 365 Deployment Readiness Tool, and it'll come up. It gets updated pretty regularly, so I just bookmark the page, and they add whatever the new update is. So this latest one is May 2012. But they update it regularly, and you just come down here. It's a very small EXE, and when you run it, it just pulls up a web page, and then it saves everything to the root of your C drive in a folder so that you can take all that and you can zip it up and send it wherever you need to send it. All right, so some common discovery tools on top of that. Some of the things that really will help you on the front end, the Exchange Best Practices Analyzer. With 2007, 2010, that's built into the tools menu on the Exchange Management Console. Some other ones that we have out there are the Exchange Connectivity Tester. For anyone that's running a hybrid mode configuration, which I think I had about 15 conversations yesterday morning about, where they could see FreeBSD one way, but they couldn't see FreeBSD the other way. So anyone that was in the cloud couldn't see on-prem. I would say, did you go to test Exchange Connectivity? Nope, I haven't gone there yet. Okay, so we pulled up the console, and we ran it, and sure enough, their auto-discover wasn't set up right. So this is a great website you can go to, and you can check a lot of things. You can check you know, your connectivity, your auto-discover setup. You can also test a single sign-on and ADFS, so you can provide an account that is supposed to have ADFS, and it'll validate and make sure that your tokens are passing back and forth properly and that you're actually validated and that you can connect in. And the other one there is the Office 365 DNS checker. This one was actually created by one of the Office 365 MVPs over in Australia, and we'll pull it up here shortly, but it's a nice little website you can go to that you can plug in your namespace, and it will tell you if all of your DNS records are set up correctly. Now, there's a little kind of asterisk next to that. When you're running in an extended hybrid mode, you don't necessarily want all of your DNS settings to be the way they are when you log into the portal and go to DNS settings and it says, you know, set your auto discover here and set your MX record here. You don't necessarily want that because you may want to keep your centralized mail flow. So the DNS settings that are in the console are meant for at the very end of the migration, once you're 100% complete, that's what your DNS should look like. So it's one thing that they say change these DNS settings, but they don't necessarily say when. And I run into a lot of customers that have that problem. So it's something definitely good to check. We can see here the two websites. So the remote connectivity analyzer, again, you can check ActiveSync, AutoDiscover. You can synchronize and check Exchange Web Services, check Outlook connectivity, and do some email tests with SMTP in and out. And then over in the Office 365, this came online, let's say about 6 months ago, maybe a little longer. That gives you the ability to test once you're in the cloud, and once you have your tenant set up, you can test single sign-on, test with accounts that are up in the cloud. You know, since post-service pack 2 for Exchange 2010, 99% of the time, this side will be fine. When you convert to the Exchange side, you may run into problems. But it's a great site to be able to come in and check, and I highly recommend anyone that's doing an Exchange to the cloud migration, use this site before you set up your hybrid mode. And make sure that all of these tests pass 100%. You know, make sure that you have a valid public cert on your mail server. Make sure that your ADFS has a public cert. Make sure that all your ports are open. Because this not only will check to make sure your cert's okay, but it'll check to make sure that your ports are all open and listening. It'll actually validate and log into your account if you select the right settings. So it'll test all the various scenarios, and you can really drill down and understand exactly where it is. And it also gives you a chance to validate back because you can save the report. And say, well, no, I know it's right. And if you have to troubleshoot with Microsoft further, then you can come back and you say, well, no, I checked that. Because when you call support, this is also the first place they'll tell you to check. All right, so back to the source environment, understanding where you're migrating from. Do you have Active Directory in place currently, or do you not? I've done a couple migrations where we've actually done an entire system migration from GroupWise and Novell to AD and Office 365 at the same time. And how is that going to impact your migration? The biggest problem we run into when we do that is the batch migration of 2,000 or 3,000 users migrating their desktops. You know, how do we sequence that in with moving their mailboxes? The mailboxes were ready to rock. We're you know, cruising. I'm ready to go. And all of a sudden, they're like, yeah, we have 20 desktops migrated. We're going to do 20 a day for the next 60 years, whatever it was. You know, so it's like, okay, well, call me, you know, next Christmas when you're ready to go, and I'll come back and migrate some mailboxes for you. So, you know, really understanding the sequencing and how you want the events to be sequenced. Originally, they thought, well, we'll move the workstations. But how does that impact? Or they wanted to move their mailboxes first. I'm sorry. How does that impact when your desktop isn't joined to the domain? So they all had Windows machines, and they met the requirements, but now they have to install the single sign-on app, and they're not part of the domain, and how does that impact Outlook? How does that impact single sign-on? Because they're not going to get true single sign-on. They're not part of the domain, so it would just be like they're outside. So even though they're in the network, and we've told them, yes, you get single sign-on, and you log into OWA, and click, everything shows up, well, they started getting pop-ups, and they're yelling at me because, you know, I told them it was a seamless solution, and it wasn't, and it was because their workstations weren't migrated. So understanding those key considerations of how you're going to sequence your migrations are really important. The other one I've run into is, again, updating the Outlook client. I've had a couple customers that says, oh, we'll migrate 100, you know, we'll push 100 clients out using SCCM with Office 2010, and then we'll do 100 migrating their mailboxes, and then while you're migrating those mailboxes, we'll do another 100, and it's like, no, it's not a good idea. You're just trying to do too much in one thing, and sometimes managing those expectations is, like I said, it's harder than the actual migration itself. The technical side, over time, becomes easy. It's managing the expectations of the non-technical that becomes the challenge. And again, can you migrate in short order, or is it going to be a long process? If you're moving 1-200 users, do you want hybrid mode? Do you need it? Do you want to just do a cutover migration? Are you going to use single sign-on? You know, what are all those various components, and how easy or difficult can it be? I got into this mindset of, you know, everything's going to be ADFS and everything's going to be hybrid configuration. And I talked to a customer and went through my whole spiel, and you know, they said, okay, here's George, he's going to talk to you. And I sat up for about 30 minutes talking. And then I said, well, how many mailboxes? They said 150. I said, okay, ignore the last 45 minutes of what I said. We're going to do a cutover migration. I'll be over this weekend. So, you know, understanding you don't necessarily need the complexity just because it's there. You know, you could just literally turn on your tenant and be ready to go and just migrate your mailboxes up, especially if you're doing a migration from an IMAP source like Google. You run into some specific problems. IMAP migrations, you can't migrate over calendars or contacts or notes. So you have to take that into consideration in how you're going to migrate those. Are you going to, you know, have your users back up that data? Do they have that data in the first place? You know, if you back it out, it's going to be in CSV file format, and are all the headers going to match up so that when you re-import the data, it's actually going to show up in the right place? So there's a lot of, you know, considerations when you're migrating from a source like that as well. And then when it comes to Active Directory considerations, what I'm really focusing on here is Active Directory as it relates to single sign-on. The biggest concern and worry that a lot of people have to deal with their UPN. Everyone, okay, not everyone. Most people deal with a .local or a .ad or a .non-routable in their Active Directory. And how is that going to be impacted if I have to change my, you know, UPN? Every time someone hears UPN, they say, I have to, you know, rename my domain. And no, you don't have to rename your domain. You know, you can go in as an admin, you can go into domains and trust, and you can add an alternate UPN. And that alternate UPN will then show up. So when you open up a user account and you go into their account properties, within the dropdown, they'll have their .local address, but then they'll also have the new address that you've added. And that happens instantaneously, relatively instantaneously, depending on how much of a mess your AD is. But, you know, and what are the impacts of that? Like I said, I mean, I've done migrations for thousands of users, and I ran into one situation where the UPN actually was a problem. And it wasn't with the UPN that was the problem, is they had an Oracle single sign-on application that hard-coded into the application how they were going to see someone nodding, so they know about it, how the single sign-on application was using their .local. And, you know, they once again halted the migration, and everyone freaked out, and, you know, firestorm, and, you know, it was crazy. And it turned out we called Oracle, and Oracle had an application to fix it, and they ran through, and they did just a database update. And it basically just ripped out the .local, and it put in their .net or .org, and they were good to go. And it was as simple as that. But it is important to understand what the applications are and how they're going to be impacted. I've seen the kind of gamut of responses where I had a company do a two-month evaluation of every single application and how it's going to be impacted, where 99% of them, we knew out of the gate they weren't going to be impacted. You know, Office doesn't care what your login is. You know, most VPN appliances don't necessarily care. Most users log in with domain name slash their username anyway. And some applications don't care as long as that UPN is one of the available ones. It doesn't necessarily need to be the one it's set to, as long as it's available. And then also, how's your force and domain functional level? You really just need to meet the 2003 functional level to be able to move to Office 365 and to use ADFS. But if you are using it as an excuse to move up to a different version, you know, what exactly are the impacts going to be? And the example that I come up with is I had a customer that decided to go to 2008 R2, and they had some legacy applications that could no longer used the hashed algorithms that were a legacy carryover from an NT. So their application would stop authenticating. Once the user logged in, it didn't use the same algorithm. It had a more complex algorithm. So we actually had to go back and bring up a 2003 domain controller and kind of hack through the system a little bit. But it was a hiccup that I wasn't necessarily expecting, because they were demanding to go to 2008 R2, which wasn't a requirement, but it was something that was important to consider. 2008 R2 obviously has, you know, a lot tighter security, and you know, it gets rid of a lot of the legacy stuff that kind of 2000 and 2003 kept around, just because it's kind of like public folders. We're going to get rid of them, we swear we're going to get rid of them, and they're still somehow around. Luckily with 365, they're not. All right, and so kind of talking about the ADFS and how ADFS is laid out, there is a lot on this diagram, but this is Inatec Industries, and my recommendation for them for their ADFS deployment. There's a lot of information out there as to how to deploy ADFS and what the best scenario is. Should it be on a DC? Should it be on a dedicated? Do I need a proxy? Do I not need a proxy? Microsoft talks about network load balancing. because they don't have hardware load balancers. So, you know, do you want NLB? Do you want HLB? You know, in my personal opinion, I really like hardware load balancers. Unicast and switches do not like each other, especially in a VM environment where you have to go in and set promiscuous mode and allow max spoofing if you're in Hyper-V and things like that. There's just a lot of additional configuration that I don't necessarily think's necessary. NLB can be a little bit more touchy. Hardware load balancers tend to just be more robust by nature. So kind of the layout that I always recommend to my customers, and again, it doesn't matter if you're going to decide to do single sign-on. It doesn't matter if you have 10 users or if you have 100,000 users. If single sign-on is not working, your users are screwed. They just can't do anything. As soon as single sign-on goes off, you can't get in, which actually brings up another point. If you set up a tenant, make sure if you go to single sign-on that you leave an admin account that has an on-Microsoft address. Because if you don't and single sign-on dies, you can't get in and you can't validate to Microsoft support that you have a valid account because your account is locked out because ADFS is offline. It's not a fun thing. I've run into it a couple times. But anyway, back to the 2.0. So again, because you know, regardless of the number of users you have, it's the most important part of the puzzle because it relies on your on-prem environment. So that being said, you know, my recommendation is always a minimum of at least 2 proxies, at least 2 internals. You can get away with no proxies. I don't recommend it in a large environment. You're opening up your internal network to exposure. So the proxies are there to protect you from that. They do a couple other things, but the primary reason is so that you have that, you know, DMZ there to block that traffic and make sure that it's handling all those requests so you're not opening yourself up to any problems. And then with the hardware load balancers, you know, if you're going to get one, why not get 2? So, you know, load balance your hardware load balancers. There's actually a couple vendors here that have some really good ones. I use Kemp quite exclusively. I used to use the Barracudas as well. They have some really good ones. I have some customers out there that have the F5s that are a $100,000 version of a Kemp. That does a lot of other things that I agree is fantastic. But for this purpose, you don't need to spend $100,000 to load balance your ADFS farm. If you have it, great. If you don't, pay a couple grand for a Kemp. They're well worth it. So again, in this diagram, kind of also shows the flow. One of the other big questions that always scares the non-technical and the uninformed technical is that if I set up ADFS, all of a sudden my passwords are leaving my perimeter. Well, they're not. ADFS uses SAML tokens to authenticate, so when your user goes up to the cloud and they try and log into ADFS, the Federated Gateway redirects you back to your ADFS proxy servers, which then validate internally on your network, and assuming that you put the right credentials in, hands off a token, and that token goes up into the cloud. And Microsoft has this really neat slide that does all the steps, but it scares me, so I figured I would just explain it and make it easier. Okay, it's a good question. The question was asked, what do you do if your site loses power and you lose part of that connectivity? There's a couple different options there, and that's one of the big concerns that a lot of people have, and that's one of the things that Microsoft is really investigating is how to allow a more robust ADFS infrastructure because you're relying on your on-prem environment. And in the smaller environments, it's difficult because you may only have a single site. You may not have the ability to put in a DR site or something like that. And in that case, you're really, you know, that has to be a really important business decision to understand and really look at the history and say, okay, well, you know, how often is my network going offline? Does it go offline? I've worked in a couple small businesses where at 11 o'clock every night all the power would go out, and it turned out the cleaning lady would come in and she'd plug in her vacuum into the UPS that all the servers were plugged into, and bam, everything would go offline. So, I've seen quite a few things. So that's a very important concern to... I don't really know or have any information on what the next steps are. All I know is that they are actively working on it, and it's a very important. It's a lot of feedback from the community is specifically about that and how to address it. And I know it is being addressed, but I don't really have anything beyond that. Again, moving to the cloud and using ADFS doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have... No, you know, you're going to get rid of all your infrastructure. Now, your infrastructure costs won't necessarily be significant. They can be virtual. They don't need to be physical boxes. You could get away with a single server. You could multi-purpose the server. My recommendation from a best practices standpoint is suck it up, pay a little bit extra, get dedicated boxes, or virtual or physical, but dedicated boxes that just do ADFS, and that's all they do. Put your servers in the proxy, you know, get the public certificate, and you know, set it up this way and using hardware load balancing. You can use network load balancing too. Again, I do use it quite a bit with my customers. They just don't like to buy hardware load balancers. If you do, you know, the gotchas are, if you're running in a VM environment or a Hyper-V environment, watch the promiscuous mode. VMware calls it promiscuous mode. Hyper-V has a checkbox within the host that says allow for MAC spoofing, because you're using your unicast NLB, which, you know, spoofs the MAC address, which scares a lot of things, and it can packet storm your VM environment. And also some switches and routers, depending on what type of switch or router they are, they may block that traffic, again, because of the promiscuous mode. And some of the things I've seen, especially with the Cisco routers, is you have to go in and flush the ARP cache after you set up unicast, just to flush out any of the old entries. And once you do, then traffic starts flowing normally. The other thing, in terms of ports and firewalls, this is just a 443 opening. So you have 443 into your DMZ. And there are a humongous list of IP addresses for the various services. For ADFS, it just has to be open. It's not a specific address, because it, actually the request comes from your computer. So it's wherever you are in the world that you may have. So it's not like with Exchange Online, you can say, okay, I only want to open up this, you know, address range, which you can do. But with ADFS, it's just an open 443, which again is why you want to lock that down to the DMZ and not allow that traffic in. And then from the DMZ into your LAN is, again, just 443 from your load balancer, or from your devices themselves, and then down into the load balancers of your internal farm. All right, so some of the client considerations, and we touched on it a little bit, but you know, what applications do your users currently use, and how do they access mail? I've had customers that have migrated, again, from, you know, Notes clients and GroupWise clients over to Outlook. I've had customers that have gotten rid of it completely and just gone with Outlook Web Access. And you know, what are the implications there? How different is it? You know, user buy-in can make or break your migration. So making sure that your clients are happy, your end users are happy, is going to be really important. You know, and then not only that, but how well maintained are your desktops, and do they meet the minimum requirements? The requirements aren't outrageous. I work in state and local, so they seem outrageous, because for some reason I'm still migrating people off of NT. It's 2012, but NT still seems to be around. Just did a migration from 5.5 about 6 months ago. That was fun times. But they are important considerations, because some of your customers may have a fleet of, you know, XP, SP1, or Windows 2000. If they have anything beyond 2000, run. Or be, you know, before that, definitely run. But are they compliant, and do they meet all the requirements? And how are you going to gather that information? In a small environment, it may not be bad. You have a couple help desk guys, they run around, they get an Excel file, and they just check off the boxes and make sure, okay, I'm, you know, XP Service Pack 3, I'm Vista Service Pack 2, I have Outlook 2007 SP2, check, 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 I'm good to go. In a larger environment, it's not really, or a very geographically diverse environment, that's not really feasible. So what else can you use? Can you use SCCM to go out there and gather that information? And I found that tool amazingly helpful in the past, especially with that customer I was telling you about that had that problem where, you know, no, we have Service Pack 2, and it turned out they didn't have Service Pack 2. What we ended up doing is bringing one of our SCCM experts to go through into a task sequence that would basically go through, and it would get a collection of computers and say, okay, if you're Windows XP, you're going to check this, this, and this, and if it's not installed, then check this, you know, install this. And the nice thing about the task sequences with an SCCM is, if one of the tasks fails or doesn't work, it doesn't break the whole process. It'll continue on to the next step. So what they were doing previously is they were just, you know, trying to install all these packages in order, and if the package failed, then the next seven packages failed. And that ended up causing a lot of problems, because, you know, the SCCM guys, understandably overwhelmed, he's trying to do 7,500 machines and get them up to speed, and they're across, you know, the entire county, and it's, you know, some people are up in hills and mountains with DSL connections, and so it was really important for them to understand how to leverage an SCCM-type product to get their desktops up to speed. And then there were a certain amount of desktops that they couldn't get up to speed. So we took those and we isolated those out of the environment and said, okay, well, these users aren't going to move, at least for right now. So we kept them on-prem for a little while, and then once they got up to speed, then we brought them up. Some considerations for Exchange 2003. First of all, 2003 is a huge lover of public folders, which is not allowed in Office 365. And not really allowed in 2010, but they have it there. So hopefully one day public folders will really go away, but for now they're there. So understanding what we're going to do with the public folders, and not only the public folders, but how public folders affect FreeBSD. In 2003, FreeBSD is controlled through a public folder. In 2010, it's the availability service. So how are my users in the cloud going to be able to see FreeBSD information for people that are on 2003? Because the cloud does not have the ability to see a public folder, and vice versa. How are my 2003 users going to look up the availability service? Right, so how exactly is that going to work, and what are the implications there? And the answer to that is getting the hybrid server in place. If you have a 2003 server there, you need to put a hybrid server in place and add not only the CAS and the hub roles, but you have to add the mailbox role. And within that mailbox role, add a public folder and replicate your FreeBSD over to the public folder. Now, one of the big arguments that a few of my friends used to like to get in with me is, you know, the original documentation said, migrate the FreeBSD replica to the 2010 server and remove all other replicas. And in the early adopter program, that was the way it is. You could only have that single copy. But since then, I've done a few migrations, and I haven't found anything documented on it yet, but when you migrate between the two, if you set that replica up to your 2010 hybrid server, you don't necessarily need to remove your 2003 replica, which actually saves you a little bit of headache because each 2003 client has a public folder reference within the database itself. So it's really important. It makes things a lot easier, but it's a really important consideration to have when you're doing the FreeBSD lookups, to make sure that you get that replica on your hybrid server, and that can be accessed, and that acts as that intermediary between the two environments, where 2010 will use the availability service, it'll come back to the hybrid server, which will convert it and look at it in the FreeBSD folder, and then it'll convert it over and vice versa. So you get that availability between all of your environments together. What is the right way to configure a hybrid server? When you have 2003, again, you need that mailbox role. Do you need multiple mailboxes? Do you need to have redundancy there? Do you need to have your public folder in some sort of DAG? In my opinion, not necessarily. Your DAG is going, you know, it's going to give you that high availability, but, you know, it's a public folder replica. Depending on the size of your environment, it's not that hard to re-replicate that data over if your database were to fail. But it depends. If you have to have that 100%, maybe you do want to get a little bit of a higher availability within it. Also, how the UI changes for OWA. You know, your 2003 users are used to looking at it a certain way. If you decide to centralize all of your mail flow and centralize all of your access, your users are going to be coming into your 2010 hybrid server, and then when they log in, they'll be redirected. So if they have a mailbox in 2003, they'll be redirected. If they're in the cloud, they'll get the little link that says your mailbox has moved to the cloud, add it to your favorites, and they click that, and then they move to the cloud. A lot of customers like that because it is one less confusing point during the migration to the users. They say, hey, everyone, we're going to go to mail.customer.com. And everyone goes there, and they have the same login, and it's very seamless to them, and then they go. But how does that impact your users and what they're used to? The 2003 interface and the 2010 interface are light years apart. So really getting them to understand, are the users ready for it? Do you have, again, the training out there for your users so that they know how to change the settings? If they accidentally click the, low sight version and, the blind version and the screen's all crazy and it doesn't look like the guy next to them who didn't click that button, how do they back out of there? How do they get into the settings and change that? And then what's your strategy for cutting services over? If you read through the enterprise deployment guide, it has this nice set of instructions, and it says, okay, and then you switch and you change your inbound and outbound flow to your 2010 hybrid server, and you redirect people for an OWA perspective and auto-discover. But in reality, it's kind of a nightmare. It's not really, but if you're not ready for it, it really can be. If you're looking at the hybrid server, especially if you have Macs or people that are using an older version of, say, Entourage, where they can't use the Exchange Web Services, how does that impact your migration? And how, when you do that cutover, are you ready for the implications of it? Some of the things we've done in the past is we've had the hardware load balancer directing traffic for our CAS array. And the hardware load balancer will actually look for clients that have a legacy version. So they'll actually look in the header of the traffic as it passes through. And if it sees an older version of Entourage requesting a packet, it'll automatically redirect it to the legacy server so that it doesn't lose that, drop that request. So it's some of the things that you need to consider, because again, that's what your users see and what they're going to end up hating you for once you say, okay, we're cut over, yay, and everyone comes with pitchforks. And then what are your rollback options? Are you easily able, once you cut your services over, to flip them back if you need to? If you switch to, routing your mail through your 2010 send connectors, what's going to happen if the send connector isn't working properly, or you don't have the security rights set up on it properly, and all of a sudden mail flow stops and your queues are huge, and your routing group connector between 3 and 10 isn't bidirectional, so mail goes one way, but it doesn't go the other, or if the user's on a certain, hub transport server, they can't route their mail properly. So knowing where all your options are to come back and say, okay, it's not quite where we want it, let's roll it back and let's retake a look at it again, and make sure that you have that backout plan, because if you don't, many long, sleepless, sweaty nights in a server room. All right, so source environments. Looking at Domino and GroupWise. A couple of the vendors are actually here. Down at the booths, Quest and MigrationWiz, or BitTitan, who runs MigrationWiz. Really looking at what are the other considerations here. You may not get all the full fidelity that you're going to get with an exchange migration. FreeBSY lookups, room resources, scheduling resources, and things like that. How does all that come into play here? I have a little diagram here. Quest is going to love me because I use their tools pretty exclusively. I've used the MigrationWiz as well, but I'm one of those guys. I like my migration tools to be on-prem for some weird reason, even though I'm a cloud specialist. It's kind of an oxymoron, but hey. So taking a look at a typical migration, and again, this comes into what if I don't even have an AD? So in this scenario, we're using the Quest NDS migrator to migrate from the E directory to Active Directory, and then using the Quest GroupWise migrator for Exchange to migrate the email data. So they all use that same metaverse to synchronize all the data together. So it brings your users over from the one side to the other, and it links them together. But then also the Quest GroupWise tool uses that. And Quest also has another tool that is not as easy as the book tells you how to deploy it, but the Coexistence Manager, which actually will help with FreeBSY lookups. The trick with it is having a shared namespace isn't really supported through that tool. And it doesn't tell you until about 40 pages into their deployment guide, which I would figure would be number one, hey, do this first. But for some reason, it's not. So you end up having to roll back and say, okay, well, within, say in a Domino environment, you create a SMTP alias that's something like, lotus.customername.com. And that allows you to do the FreeBSY, but then you also need to buy an additional certificate that will handle that so that when you do the auto-discover lookups for autodiscover.lotus.customer.com, that it knows to go to that server, and that server acts as kind of the hybrid server for that environment that allows you the FreeBSY lookup. So it's a little bit tricky. I'm actually working through one of the migrations right now, and it's proving to be difficult, but hopefully once I get it done and it's working, we'll be able to post an article on my blog and help you guys out with that. So, and then this is kind of how the whole flow goes from a migration where you didn't have any AD and didn't have anything. So it's completely Novell and GroupWise. So, again, the E directory uses the Quest migrator to populate Active Directory. Active Directory then uses DirSync to populate those accounts in the cloud so that you have that consistent link between the objects and the three completely separate environments. And then you use the GroupWise migrator for Exchange to link the user between the Novell environment and the Office 365 to migrate that data up to the cloud. So it kind of gives you, you can see here, a migration from a third-party tool isn't necessarily easy or fun. There's a lot of considerations that come into play. Again, I use the Quest tools and the BitTitan tools a little bit, but the Quest tools seem to be the most consistent out there. It's got some quirks. It's got some things it doesn't do fantastically. The migration speed, so if you're migrating from Exchange to the cloud, your throughput is going to be about 7 times what it is if you're using this. So some of the things you can do with a Quest migrator is you can actually set up a whole bank of Quest migration tools, and with each one of those tools, you can set a different account, so that account will be the account that migrates the data up to the cloud. what ends up happening is if you use a single user and you migrate, say, 60 users in a batch, you're going to be throttled. But if you use 10 migration stations, each with a different user account, each of those user accounts migrating 10 users, that won't get throttled because it's 10 separate accounts that are using up those threads. So it's a kind of a good way to get around it. And I've done as many, I've had 20 workstations running, 10 migrations at a time, and I've been able to move 300-400 mailboxes in a night, where if you had a single migration station, you might move 16 in a day. You know, I've seen mailboxes take 4 or 5 days. That, you know, a six gig mailbox take 4 or 5 days. So it can be tricky. So a little bit about the hybrid deployments. We touched on it a little bit, but someone had brought up about ADFS and what happens if your server goes offline. Same thing with a hybrid server. If you look at all the deployment guides, it's here's how to deploy a hybrid server. It doesn't say here's how to deploy a hybrid array or here's failover and high availability. The good thing is there's nothing really to it. It's just like setting up, you know, you're setting up a kit for a standard migration where we're taking 2003 out of the mix. You're doing, you know, say 2 or 3 CAS hub servers. When you run the hybrid wizard, which I highly recommend you do rather than trying the pre-service pack 2 method, the tool itself will say, okay, well, which one are your CAS servers, which one are your hub servers, and so you actually pick them out, and it sets the setting across the entire board. So there are some additional considerations. You have to set up your CAS array. You know, you have to have the cert across all 3 servers, things like that, but it's a standard 2010 deployment where you're deploying, you know, a larger set, and then if one of your server goes offline, especially in the middle of a migration, it just fails over to the other one. So I never recommend one server for a deployment. I always recommend at least 2 during a deployment. It's not for a throughput, it's just for high availability, especially if you're going to centralize everything through it. You know, even if you're not going to keep an on-prem environment, but you're going to move 2,000 users, it's going to take you a month to do it. During that month, you don't want any downtime. If your users are using the 2010 OWA interface, or they're using that as their auto-discover point, you want to be able to have that up and running. And then how does the configuration change with 2003? We kind of touched on that a little bit. You know, you really just want to make sure that you have that free busy folder. You can add it to the DAG. It's not as critical because it can be rebuilt pretty easily. You know, but you can provide high availability there as well. And here's kind of an overflow or an overview of the flow. Looking at a 2003 with a 2010 hybrid server in there, so as all, and we have a spam appliance in there that's blocking from the outside. So this is kind of centralizing your mail flow to on-prem. So you have everything coming through your spam appliance. In this case, we just have a virtual IP address, so we're just using, you know, the CAS array. And then what that ends up doing is that ends up flowing the traffic over to 2003 if it needs to. So you have your legacy redirection, so if your user comes over here, they have the routing group connector that will send their mail over, and when you build your 2010 array, the routing group connector should automatically get connected, but sometimes it doesn't. Or sometimes not all the members of your DAG would show up in that routing group connector, so you want to make sure you go back and through the PowerShell add those members within your routing group connector so that all your 2010 servers show up in there, so that you have full redundancy in your mail flow between the legacy systems and your current systems. What we also have here is the public folder for 2010. So as the mail flow comes in, it either gets redirected to the 2003 server or it gets redirected up to the cloud. It's a little bit vague there, but you know, within the cloud you are using forefront online protection. So what ends up happening is you actually have within FOPI, they're send and receive connectors, but within the FOPI console they're called outbound and inbound connectors, which can kind of be confusing because it's which one's out and which one's in. But out would be coming back to your environment and in would be coming into the 365 environment.
Why wouldn't you just use FOPI and eliminate the spam appliance and just have it all flow through Office 365 first and then have, you know, your in-house on-prem exchange 2010?
Sure. So the question was, why wouldn't you just route it through FOPI out of the gate? And you can. There's no reason why you can't. You could have everything, you know, endpoint at FOPI and then have a connector that reroutes back to your on-prem for your users that are still there. There's no reason to do that or not to do that. A lot of people, my customers are generally, more than anything, just misinformed, and they think that's going to cause more problems. So what we usually do is we get to about 70%. Once we get to 70% in the cloud, then we flip the MX records. And then flow stays the same way. But once you set up the hybrid mode, your connectors are there, so it doesn't matter where your MX points. So, and a lot of times they think their spam appliance is the greatest thing, you know, on earth, and FOPI stinks and blah, blah, blah. And then they get there and realize that, you know, FOPI's a lot better than their spam appliance. All right, now we're going to look at some automation through PowerShell, so some of the fun stuff. If you're doing migrations, there are some limitations when, you know, if you're migrating mailboxes through the Exchange Management Console, you do run into some limitations. If you were migrating from 3 to 10, you can specify corrupt items. So in 2003, that's really important, because 2003, there's always a corrupt item. But what ends up happening when you do a remote mailbox move, if you do it through the GUI, you don't have that ability. You can't specify what your corrupt items are. You can also not specify what large items are. So through the PowerShell, you can. So you can add that ability. You can also just make your life a lot easier because, you know, if you're migrating 5, 10,000 users, you can export out a CSV of a group of users, put them into a CSV, and then run one PowerShell script that automatically queues them all up, and you're done. Rather than, you know, finding the subset of users and then going through the whole step and clicking through a 10-click wizard and kind of migrating. And then not only that, but you can also go through, you can license your users through PowerShell. You can set their usage location, which is one of the two requirements of setting them to the US or whatever the zone might be. You can do mass updates. So again, we talked about the UPN. I've had customers that don't like PowerShell, and they've decided that they're going to actually update 7,500 users manually by going into each user property and clicking and dropping down, where I clicked a button and I had everything done in 5 seconds. And you can scope it by OU. Again, migrating large batches of user, converting resources, so converting them over. You know, if they're 2003, you want to convert them to an actual room resource because, you know, they don't show up as rooms properly in 2003. They're just mailboxes. And setting them for auto-booking so that they can auto-accept and auto-decline appointments. And then getting mailbox sizes so that you can determine move sequences. With larger size mailboxes, anything over 2 gigs, if you're moving them from 2003, you can still run into some problems. It used to be a lot more of a problem where you'd actually, anything over 2 gigs, the recommendation was to move them to 10 first and then the cloud, because what you would end up is the mailbox would kind of hang at a certain point and it would go into what's called a transient failure. And it's basically a timeout from 2003. Where it was timing out the connection to the cloud, and it didn't have that the amount of latency to be able to kind of just wait a few minutes. But every time it went to transient failure, you'd have to wait 5 minutes before it would restart. So if you had a 5-6 gig mailbox, it would take days to migrate. You know, and it's always the most important people that happens to. So taking a look here and some of the scripts that we have here. So we have the update UPN. So this one is basically just run from the standard PowerShell. So, you know, import the Active Directory. And then you can see here we're doing a search based on the base OU. So this is going to run an entire domain. You could do it specific to an OU. So you could say you're moving your users based on their OU because you had your OUs based on their geography. You could go in and say, okay, I'm going to move these OUs, and you could run that update on them and then just kind of update this one little script. The script itself takes, well, depends on your environment, but, you know, say a 20,000 user environment, it takes less than 5 minutes. Then it just carriage returns down. If you run into any problems, it'll give you the nice big red giant text telling you where your script's wrong. But you can see here all it's doing is it's just going through and it's filtering the entire environment based on that domain. And for each of the objects, it's creating a complete UPN by grabbing the SAM account name and adding the variable that I've actually added, which is @domain.com. And then it just sets that AD user to whatever my complete UPN is. So it's a nice, quick, and easy way to do that. There's a ton of things you can do here. These are just a lot of the ones that I seem to run into every time, so I just created scripts to save myself the headache, and then I just hand them off to my customers, and it seems to make them happy. Here's a bulk activation script. Now, this one, for anyone that's kind of worked in the various PowerShell command lists, there's the Microsoft Services Online module for PowerShell that you use to configure ADFS. You need to download and install that, but you don't necessarily need to run that specifically. You can run everything from PowerShell 2.0. There's one line in here that I didn't actually add, that if you just do an import module MS online, as long as you have the module installed, it will pull all those commandlets into your local PowerShell session so that you can run all of the commandlets here, the MSOL commandlets. So connect MSOL, you know, add MSOL user, add MSOL group. The difference is anything with the MSOL is, the way I kind of liken it to is you're modifying the Active Directory piece in the cloud. So it's the licensing of the users and things like that, where when you actually connect to PowerShell 2.0 using the remote shell, that's where you are managing the mailbox. So that's kind of more of the Exchange Management shell versus the AD Management shell. But you can combine the two into a single PowerShell, and you can see here, now one of the things we have here is if you look at the account SKU ID, where it just says SKU: Enterprise Pack, that as an actual variable that you'd have to end up changing. And what you'd end up doing is if you go into the PowerShell and you run get-msolaccountSKU, it will tell you all the different SKUs that your tenant is subscribed to. And usually that SKU ahead is usually what your tenant name is. So if my tenant is george.onmicrosoft.com, it's going to be george:enterprise pack. Or if it's a pplan, it may say standard pack. But that's important that you have that in there. And it also allows you, you can go through and you can actually drill down. So if, say you only wanted to license your users for Link and not for the entire, or just Exchange Online, you can go through and look at all your SKUs and see exactly what you want your users to license. And for anyone that's actually gone through the portal and licensed your user, you know what a pain it is because you have to click it, you pick the license, and then you go over and you pick the usage location, then you say okay, and then you say okay again. For some reason, it makes you say it twice. So this, you know, in a single click, you're done. And again, it just goes iteratively through. And this one pulls from a user.csv. So you could change it and you could, you know, import it from any various source you want. But for my purposes, I just do it through a user CSV. And I go into AD, I export out the user principal name into a CSV file, and then I parse that out by department, and then I do my batches of users so that I only activate the users that I have to activate. I don't necessarily want to activate my entire environment. You know, with an environment of, oh, I bought 19,000 licenses, but I have 45,000 users. You don't want to migrate that delta. You just want to migrate the users that you actually have. And here's one of our batch move requests. So this one's a little bit interesting because it actually pulls credentials twice. So in the top half, it's actually pulling your tenant credentials so that you can log in using the remote PowerShell. And some of the things it does here is you can see the $password converts to secure string. What that's doing is, in this script, I actually populate my text file or my script file with my password. It's not necessarily a best practice, but it sits on my machine, and my machine's locked, and I've got, you know, robots and things watching, so it's always fine. But you don't necessarily have to do that. I do because I don't like, when I run the script, I don't like to see a pop-up. And in this one specifically, you need two sets of credentials because you need your cloud credentials to connect your remote session, but then you need your on-prem credentials because that's what's going to be used for the move request because you're move requesting locally and sending it to the cloud. So it grabs my credentials, converts it to a secure string, and then comes down and runs the actual, connects to the actual session, and then re-ups my credentials with my local domain user, converts it to a secure string, grabs the list of users from my user.csv, and then for each one, it does a move request for them. And you can see here, the last two line items here, it does a bad item limit and a large item limit. So I get around that worrying about corrupted items. It's the biggest nightmare, moving, especially from 2003. There just always seems to be a corrupt item, and we couldn't get around that. And finally, we figured, okay, if you do it through PowerShell, that's going to save you. And the large item limit, both of those are set to 1. So if you hit 1 corrupt item or 1 large item, your entire migration fails, and it really is not fun. So it allows you to set that up. And you know, it gives you a little bit more control of what you're doing. And the one thing there is if you do a bad item limit, I want to say if you go over 50, so once you hit 51, you actually have to add another switch called, it's like acknowledge acceptable, allow large data loss, yeah. So it's basically saying, yeah, I know I'm going to lose a ton of my email, but that's cool. So you have to set that because Microsoft doesn't want to be responsible when all of a sudden you have 100 corrupt mail items that don't get migrated and your, you know, CIO is screaming at you. It's like, well, I did say accept large data loss. So yeah, there are a couple other switches that you have to have in there. Now, this one's really good while you're migrating. You can go into the Exchange Management Console, and you can see all of your move requests there, and you can click on them, and it'll show you the percentage that it's done and how many items it's moved. But if you do it through PowerShell, you can do a couple different things here. Top part there, again, it's just connecting up to the session. The first line there, get move request, and then bar get move request statistics. What that's going to do is that's going to list out every single user. It's going to tell you what percentage they're complete and actually what stage they're in. So it's actually moving an item, it's creating the folder hierarchy, it's finalizing, it's completed. So it's a really quick way to get a nice spit out of every single user, what their status is. And that's the one, when I was talking about that transient failure, this is where you'll see that. You won't see that in the Exchange Management Console. You'll only see that in the shell. And when you start seeing transient failure, you'll still probably see it because sometimes things do time out and it will restart. But that one is a really, really important one because if you start seeing that transient failure over and over, just cancel it, save yourself the headache, clean up the dude's mailbox or the person's mailbox and move on to the next one. The other one there, the get move request specific to the identity of a, so this is getting the move request for a specific user. And if you don't do the bar FL there, you will just get the user's name and what their status is. If you do the FL, that's a full list. That'll show every single attribute. And this is really important. If you're moving a large set of users, you may start getting throttled, especially if you do it over the weekend, because BPOS is moving millions of people off of BPOS and, you know, eventually live at EDU and all that stuff. So they're doing all kinds of moves on the back end. If you run the get move request, it'll actually show you where you are in the queue. So it'll say you're number 12 of 758 in the queue. If you are migrating a humongous batch of users, if say you have I'd say anything over 10,000 users, you can put a special exception in with Microsoft. Tier 1 will always tell you no, escalate it. And just say, we need a special exception, we're going to be migrating our users from here to here, and they will actually open up the throttling bandwidth for you. I've run into it a lot, Tier 1 always tells you no. Tier 2 usually says no, and then Tier 3 says okay. And sometimes I have to get my TAM involved, sometimes I have to get Premier involved, sometimes I have to call a few architects and, you know, pull a few strings. But be persistent with it, because you can get that, and especially if it's on a very specific subset of time. So if it's only for a one-month period or a two-week period, whatever it might be. But it'll be really important, because if you're moving batches of 500 users at a time, and you can only queue up 4 of them at a time, yeah, it's not going to be very fun for anybody. Here's one for configuring auto-booking. So again, the top part there is just connecting up our session. And then what this is doing is it's basically going through and it's finding anywhere where resource type is set to room or equipment, and it's setting the calendar processing to auto accept. So it's a nice way to go through. You can specify this to a subset. You could, you know, say here's my CSV of rooms that I want to auto accept. You may not want all your rooms to auto accept. I don't think I've ever been to a customer yet that doesn't have them auto accept. So. It gives them that option there. So it's just, again, another way to automate that through, especially if you have 100, 200 resources across, you know, a lot of different buildings and things like that. Troubleshooting the hybrid config wizard. The hybrid wizard is fantastic. For anyone that was pre-Service Pack 2, you will know the book was 70 pages and like 200 steps, and it was a nightmare because it never worked quite right, and there was always a problem with free busy lookups, and you had to add that service.domain and exchange delegation.domain. It was never very fun. Service Pack 2 eliminates all that. It makes things very, very simple. The one thing I would say is that for those of you who didn't experience the pain of pre-Service Pack 2, just make sure you understand what gets done under the hood. I actually just wrote an article that'll be coming out in Windows IT Pro magazine in about a month, specifically deconstructing it, because my biggest concern is that people will run it, and then when they run into a problem, they won't know how to fix it because they don't know what's going on in the background. I mean, it does a lot. It sets up both your organizational relationships. It sets up the free busy lookups. It sets centralized mail flow. It creates your send and receive connectors. I mean, it does a ton of stuff. But for the admin, it's like 6 clicks, and you add a DNS record, and that's it, and then you're done. So understanding it's really important. And one of the biggest problems, and I see it all over the community, and I've run into it quite a bit, is when you run the wizard, it fails after about 2 minutes, and it says failed getting federation information. And the best fix I've found so far, one fix that I've seen is if you open up PowerShell and establish a remote session and then run it, it seems to work. That works about 20% of the time. Running this command here, the service model reg.exe with a -r, so it's a repair of some of the .NET framework, that actually fixes it about 95% of the time. So you just run that one command and then rerun the wizard and it gets through that step. Now, you might run into some other problems, like it may have hit the send connector and see that you already have a send connector, so it wants to add, you know, it says, oh, it's already created, or, you know, it may run into a problem where it can't find your free busy folder if you have the replica for 2003 set. So, you know, there will be other problems, but that's the big one that I see in the community out there a lot, and that's a really good, easy fix for it. Also, the accepted domains. What ends up happening is it doesn't convert your primary accepted domain to an internal relay. So when you try and send to the cloud or when someone tries to send through, it won't actually relay it to that next person. For some reason, and I think it's been fixed in Rollup 3, but just be aware, after the hybrid wizard runs, if you're having mail flow problems, make sure that your main domain is set to an internal relay. And also in the cloud, it should be set to shared domain if you go into the Exchange Control Panel. Shared domain, same internal relay, just different name for the same thing. And the other problem that I always run into seems to be firewall problems, because we open up all these, you know, you open up the subset, and Microsoft has a great list for all the FOPI addresses you need to open and all the Exchange Online and all the links. You get all those addresses in there, and I've run into at least 3 customers where we've done that, and then they've had some really old blacklist that's overriding their whitelist and is blocking traffic, and it's all my fault, but as soon as we find out, then you get the app, oh, yeah, that rule. So, you know, Telnet is your friend. That and Wireshark. Those two are your greatest friends. Throw Wireshark on a machine, have the guy log in, say, okay, well, where are you running into a problem, and go into Wireshark, and guaranteed you'll get a deny packet or a block packet. So, oh, yeah, your firewall's blocking. And then you go into the firewall, and then you get the, oh, yeah. So it's always a fun moment for an admin when you just know you're right. The other one is updating your default email policy. The wizard will fail if you have not updated. If you have 2003 in the environment, you need to update all of your email policies to 2010, or at least your default email policy. Because what it's going to do is it's going to append a domain.mail.onmicrosoft.com that it uses as a route to address to send your mail up to the cloud once your user's been migrated. So you need to make sure that that is updated to 2010, or the hybrid wizard will fail on trying to write that attribute. And it may actually finish and not write properly. And I've run into that problem before, and then what ends up happening is when you move your users to the cloud, it doesn't automatically create the route to address. You have to manually do it every time. So it's just kind of some of the things I've seen out there that are the most common problems. Troubleshooting mail flow. Again, Wireshark, reviewing the firewall logs, checking any internal proxy devices. Are you proxying internal and out, you know, outbound? Especially in the state and local, they love to proxy outbound because they don't want anyone doing anything fun, ever. So, you know, that's one thing that you always want to check is make sure, even though I have the firewalls open, are there any devices in the perimeter that may be blocking it? And the best way to do it is rather than saying, well, let's check this device, is just throw Wireshark on and just watch where the packets are stopping, what's hitting that device, and why is it blocking it? And then troubleshooting domino group-wise mail flow. Quest specifically has a method that they like to use for it. I found the easiest way to set this up is once you set your Quest tools and you put them in place, go into FOPI and you set the outbound connector, which is mail that's coming from 365. By default, it's not going to do anything. So mail's just going to be routed through MX. So if an external or if a user that's in the cloud tries to send to someone that's still in GroupWise or Domino, it'll go out, it'll use MX records to route back. Breaks a lot, you know, in terms of mail flow and header integrity, and it's a little bit difficult to troubleshoot if there's a mail flow problem. So if you go in and you set an outbound scoped connector and say anything for the internal domain routes directly to, say, their GroupWise front-end server, that will allow that traffic to come in there. And then you bypass going back out through MX to come into your internal environment. So it's kind of tricking it into a hybrid environment where the Quest tools and the BitTitan tools don't necessarily do that out of the gate. That's more of a kind of thing I've just learned along the way. And you don't necessarily need to do it, but for me, it makes it easier when there's a problem because if the MX records are broken, and especially if the customer's still using centralized mail flow with, say, Postini that doesn't like to have 10 million connections attaching, 365 likes to have 10 million connections. So, if, you know, Postini is going to block all those connection attempts, so if you route it directly to the device, you can bypass a lot of those problems. And then also checking the mail forwarding. What ends up happening in a GroupWise and Domino environment is it, instead of doing a route to address, it just basically forwards all mail. So it doesn't deliver it locally, it just forwards it to whatever their on Microsoft address is. And a lot of times, especially in GroupWise, Domino seems more stable, GroupWise not so much. You want to make sure that you're doing that, and GroupWise won't set that forwarding address properly, even though the Quest tools will force that to happen. And we got some you know, additional resources here. You know, one of the resources I will definitely recommend is the community, community.office365.com. It is a great place to go, become active in the community. The more that you post on there, you know, the more people will be kind of apt to help you. You know, there's a lot of really constructive stuff out there. There's a back-end community called The Grid that a lot of the MVPs and other big contributors are there, and we all aggregate our blogs there, and then some of the community leaders will go through and they'll find the best ones of the week or the month, and they'll post them up there so that you can take a look and, you know, see some of the tips and tricks, you know, that the guys out in the field see. And then some of the additional resources here. So thank you all for attending. Anybody have any questions? Or we got a couple minutes here, and then if we run out of time, I'll be down at the center down there for the rest of the day. So if you guys want to swing by, definitely come by. Thank you. Yes?
The other sessions earlier this week, and they were talking about like inline tool, something where it's an access database-based tool where you evaluate your environment. Didn't know if you use that yourself, and I tried to contact well, I won't say who it is, but my provider, and sure. They're not really sure where to get that. So do you have some information on that a little bit more?
Sure. Yeah, the question was about the SAIC tool, the online or the index calculator. Yes, the tool is provided right now. It's only provided to partners. So you'd have to be a partner to be able to get access to the tool or Microsoft directly. They are working on a version that will be available to the general public. I don't have any further information on it, but it should be out there. But what you can do if you want to, come down after this and talk to me, I can give you some contact info, and we can definitely help you out, because any partner should be able to help you with that tool and at no cost. Sure. Yeah, come swing by after. I'll chat with you. Okay, yeah, so the question was on the big mailboxes, what's the recommendation? It depends on where you're coming from. On a 2003 environment, I mean, we're talking big, like 10 gigs. First, I would tell the user to clean up. Always clean up. Get rid of your junk mail. Get rid of your deleted items. You know, archive out a little bit. Try and get it down. If you still have a big mailbox, if you're on 3, I would definitely do a 2-hopper. I would move you to 10 to the hybrid server first, and then I would move to the cloud. Beyond that, I would... you know, it will work. It will just take a lot longer. You know, if you're moving from a third-party source like a GroupWise or a Domino, you can use like a Quest tool to say only move the last 6 months. And then you can backfill the data and say, look, you'll get your 6 months. The rest of it you'll get eventually, but at least you have 6 months to work with. So you can do that and you can scope it down. But with an Exchange migration, you just kind of let it run and it'll eventually... Yeah, so the question was about kind of setting it up so that you can move the data later. You can do what's called a suspend at complete within Exchange, and what that will do is it's similar to using the built-in tools. If you did like an IMAP migration, you know, from Google, the user will continue to use Exchange on-prem. It will backfill all that data to the cloud, and then it will stop when it gets to, you know, 1%. And then at that point, you can just complete the request, and it just moves that delta. So you could pre-populate everything in the cloud, and then say, okay, we're going to move you this weekend. It's similar to the way they're doing the BPOS migrations. Yes, I'm sorry. You have to be 2007 and above for that. So yes, that's true. That's a very good point. Anybody else? Yes.
Is there a way for us to export this stuff to CSP, or is that not?
Sure. Yeah. So the question is, if the backend platform's hosted, what are your options? And I just got an email yesterday from one of my bosses asking that exact same question, and got in a pretty lengthy argument with one of my buddies. So, you know, you can push the hosted company to say, I need an account with the access, and you can use the built-in Exchange tools to do an Exchange to, you know, Exchange to 365 migration. Depending on how, you know, some hosted providers are okay with that because they think they're smart and they think, okay, long term, I don't want to, you know, piss this person off because eventually they may come back. Other ones are like, meh, I don't like you. So in that case, yes, you would do an IMAP migration. It depends on the size of the mailboxes. You know, if they're big mailboxes, you're probably going to want to do an IMAP migration and export out your contacts, calendar, and notes, if they use notes at all, into a PST. And you can do that through, say, the Outlook client, or if they're using something like, you know, if it was Gmail or something like that, you should be able to log into the interface and export out to PST. So you have those options. If they're smaller mailboxes, I'd probably just, yeah, use Outlook to export everything to PSTs and then just import the PSTs back. Now, you might lose a little bit with it, like replyability and some things like that, but really at that point you're just, you know, you're kind of hamstrung by your, you know, the host that you're moving from, because they're not giving you the access you need. But I would try and work out a good deal with the hoster and say, look, you know, you don't want to have a black eye because you're being, you know, sour grapes because we're leaving your platform. Just give us an account with the right access and we'll be out of your way.
So.
Yes. The question is about hosted SharePoint. I am Exchange and Link almost exclusively. If you swing down to the tech center, there's a SharePoint area there, and there's some SharePoint MVPs down there. But there are a lot of tools. Quest has a tool for migrating to SharePoint, and there's some other tools, and a lot of partners out there can help out with that. Right, yes, you can use the user credentials with that. Oh, yes, here's my MS tag. Yes. And actually, I just to be fair to the next person coming on, I'll be down at the booth, but I'm actually over my time by 5 minutes. If you just swing by the booth or grab me right out here, we'll chat, or anybody else that has a question.